You're listening to the Book Talk Today podcast, a podcast that inspires readers to obtain valuable insights to inform, educate, and improve lives. My name is Orn Abdi. I'm an avid reader, best known for the creation of the 1 Minute Book Review community, and I'm sitting down with authors to delve deeper into the books they have written to uncover the story behind the story. Today we are joined by Adrian Wooldridge. Adrian is the Economist political editor and author of the Bagot column. He is author of 10 previous books, and today we'll be discussing his most recent book, The Aristocracy of Talent: How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. Adrian, it's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. And it was very interesting, Adrian, because only a week ago I found myself dabbling back into Plato's Republic. And it was interesting because in the beginning of the book, you made reference to, obviously, Plato and the Aristocracy of Talent. And I knew I was having you on. So I thought it'd be good to do a reread and have an idea about where the origination of the Aristocracy of Talent comes from. So for anyone who's not aware of Plato and the Aristocracy of Talent and the idea of meritocracy, I think it'd be good to talk about what it is and why meritocracy is so important.
Well, meritocracy essentially means judging people on the basis of their individual abilities and individual promise rather than on the basis of their family connections or on the status that they were born to in society. It also means a little bit more than that. It means doing your very best to provide people with equality of opportunity, essentially with educational opportunities, because it doesn't make any sense to talk of meritocracy if only a tiny proportion of the population go to secondary school or to university or something like that. And these may sound like very banal sort of things, but we have to remember that for most of human history, society has worked according to very different assumptions. It's worked according to the assumptions that who your parents are, where you're born in society, should be determinative of where you end up in society. And there's been actually quite a marked prejudice against social mobility. Societies have struggled against social mobility. And the reason I really started off with Plato is that Plato sees all of this from the very start. In the Republic, he said that people have different abilities, that the role of a good society is to allocate governing positions and positions throughout society on the basis of those abilities. And he says that those abilities are not born from one generation to another. They're not continued from one generation to another. He divides society into men of gold, men of silver, and men of bronze. And he says it's quite often the case that men of gold will have silver or bronze children and vice versa. He also says that it's not always the case that men are the people with these unique abilities. It's also women. And he has a whole theory that women can be just as much capable of being aristocrats, philosopher kings, as women can be. And then he extrapolates about what that means for social policy in a very extraordinary way. So I think there isn't a single powerful argument about either the merits or demerits of meritocracy that isn't anticipated in the Republic.
Why do you think that one of the questions I did have in relation to the Republic was, why do you think after over 2,000 years since its publication, there has been somewhat a length of time where nepotism did rule, but the idea of the meritocracy that is within Plato's Republic wasn't adhered to or wasn't followed since its sort of publication?
I think meritocracy is a conscious struggle against human nature, because a fundamental impulse in human beings is to do their very best for their children. And so kinship, preference, nepotism and things like that are very innate things that societies build themselves around. And societies originally start off with kinship groups and heads of kinship groups that try and propagate their kind and perpetuate the rule of their families. So I think that's a very fundamental thing in the human species and the human psyche. So you have to build an elaborate set of institutions which push against that that wish, that natural wish. And what's one of the most extraordinary things about Plato's Republic is he understands this, and he says that in order to create a proper meritocracy or a proper system of aristocracy of talent, you have to raise children communally. You have to prevent the ownership of private property. And he even takes it to the extent that parents, fathers shouldn't know who their children are. So he says that you should have state-sponsored orgies to create the next generation in which highly intelligent men mate with highly intelligent and beautiful women and that sort of thing. Now, this may sound crazy, and indeed it is. It is slightly it is slightly crazy. But it does show that he has grasped the fundamental tension between creating, on the one hand, a society which makes the maximum use of its talents and gives a real sense of equality of opportunity, and the human impulse, not only to give advantage to your own children, but also to use public offices to accumulate private property, which is another of the things that he's really worried about. So, as I say, there isn't a single, even though Plato's solutions to these problems are extreme and non-workable, he understands what the problems are, and these are problems which have haunted the meritocratic ideal all the way through its very long and tortuous history.
Definitely, and I think the part of the reason why he comes up with that logical or rational view of it is the fact that he sees democracy as having the three critiques. And I know in the book you touched upon the three critiques that Plato gave of democracy. The first being that ordinary people don't have knowledge of the elements of good governance, and the second one being that it produces bad leaders, and the third being that it puts too much emphasis on freedom. So, do you feel like all of those are still valid critiques? Because I read those three critiques of democracy and I'm like, that seems valid even to this day.
Absolutely. The extraordinary thing about Plato argues that democracy is the most attractive of all forms of government. It's like a coat of many colours, he says, which you go to the marketplace and it catches your eye because it's so exciting. But ultimately, it is the most dangerous of all forms of government because its attractiveness is very superficial. And when you buy the coat and take it home and start wearing it, you find that it falls apart or transforms itself into something else. Plato is very concerned that democracy very rapidly becomes tyranny because people choose the most superficially attractive leader, the one who makes the most extravagant and appealing promises, and B, because the rich get worried about the power of the poorer people to expropriate their property and choose a tyrant. Now, a lot of these criticisms have been very of democracy have been very out of fashion for a very, very long time. And Plato indeed has been accused of being one of the ancestors of fascism and totalitarian thought in various ways. But it's very hard if you've been through the agony of the Trump presidency. Not to read what Plato says about democracy turning itself into tyranny and think, not to think, my God, he's saying something which is true. This is Trump that he's describing because he says the tyrant is somebody who can't control himself, who's flashy, who's uneducated, who appeals to your basest people's basest instincts. So it's hard not to get to think that there's something in what Plato says. Now, I said with all of Plato's arguments, they're too extreme and his solutions are unworkable. But there is a kernel of truth there. And I think if you look at the history of democracy, most governing regimes that would claim to be democratic have also built in a meritocratic element. They've tried to build in filters between the will of the people on the one hand and policy on the other hand. Most obviously, with the United States and its founding. Which tried to create all sorts of. They created a lower house which was very close to the people, had elections every 2 years, and was meant to reflect opinion. But they also popular opinion. But they also deliberately created filters. The Senate was given 6 years. Well, originally the Senate was elected in a complicated and different way. But it was given 6 years to cool it down a bit. The Supreme Court justices were given tenure for life. To make sure that they didn't respond just to popular opinion, but they could stick to the verities of the Constitution. So there are all sorts of filters. If you look at Britain, we've created filters. The House of Lords being, I think, particularly unattractive filter, but we've tried to create filters. The French have done exactly the same thing. So all sorts of and indeed the Germans with the upper chambers, all sorts of democratic systems recognize that for representative democracy to work very well, it also has to be constrained. And indeed, giving the independence to the Bank of England or the independence to the Federal Reserve is another way of creating institutions which are meritocratic rather than democratic. So again, I mean, we're getting fixated on Plato here, but Plato did see very deeply the nature of the future, I think.
I think it was important, though, to reference that fact, because I think that's the central theme of the book, though, in that respect. It's like, obviously, it's in the title, but it's like, where does that idea of meritocracy come from, and how is it ebbed and flowed through history, through different populations, through different civilizations? So I think it's important to reference that. One question I did have in relation to the idea of obedience and hierarchies. At the beginning of the book, you talked about like the biblical references of obedience and hierarchies, and how it's somewhat told in a certain way through the Bible in its sort of harsh and indirect ways. But do you believe that the Western adherence to formal religion and its somewhat decline has been correlated to the rise in sort of a belief in meritocracy? So as religion and formal religion has declined and people follow it, there's been a somewhat increase corollary to the rise in meritocracy?
To some extent, well, Christianity is particularly interesting here because, on the one hand, there is a very conservative element in Christianity, or at least Christianity in the way that it's been interpreted by the Catholic Church, which is this emphasis on obedience, subordination, hierarchy, the natural, the human order as being a reflection of the natural order, and indeed the family being the basic constituting order of society. But there is also this re revolutionary element in the form of Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ says essentially, I am the truth, I am the way. You must be willing to part with your family, part with your tribe, part with your traditions, and follow me. And also being a radical egalitarian, saying that hierarchies are unsupportable, that the rich man can't get to heaven, all of this sort of stuff. So there is a radically individualistic element to Christianity there, which is in tension with the formal Catholic hierarchy. And you see this tension all the way through the history of the West. You see it in some of the monastic orders, which avowed poverty, and which radical challenges to the status quo in society. You see it in the emphasis on celibacy, with the church saying we won't have, members of the church saying we won't have children, so we can dedicate ourselves entirely to the good of society. You see it with the Reformation, which rejects hierarchy and says it's, by faith alone, by your own judgment. You should make things. So I think all the way through this being meritocratic is an odd word, but an individualistic element within Christianity, because Christ was saying that the existing social order was unjust and unjustified, and that you had to turn your back on it in order to find true salvation. And the church, the Catholic Church, has been not a great vehicle of that. It supported hierarchy. It was a fundamental pillar of hierarchy. But I think it's always been that. I think with the waning of Christian religion, I don't see the waning of Christian religion as something that makes way for meritocracy. I see the waning of a particular interpretation of the Christian religion, which is the interpretation which is a feudal interpretation, essentially, that hierarchy is the thing that really matters as making way for meritocracy.
Okay, interesting. So you don't believe it's the actual religion or the faith itself. It's more the interpretation by individuals who propagated the religion.
Yes, although I would say there's a radical core to Christianity, which is individualistic, which is constantly breaking out from the carapace of formal interpretations imposed by the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah, it's interesting because in Islam, because I'm Muslim, so in
Right.
Islam there's that idea of the individual being. So the Prophet, when he came and spread the message of Islam, it was very much through the central idea that everyone was equal. So whether you're a slave, everyone is seen through this umbrella of faith, and you're all equals, or you're all brothers under the same banner of faith. So I can see that. But the difference, especially in Christianity, is the fact that we don't have somewhat like a papal view of the way that the religion spread. Like, there's not a pope in that sense, and we don't follow a pope, and we don't have this system and this hierarchy of obedience through it. So I just think it's interesting to make those distinctions.
I think I certainly didn't talk enough in the book about Islam. I thought that the book covered enough ground without trying.
Yeah,
to,
I think if you added the Islamic aspect, I was like, oh, that this one might be a bit too much to take in.
Yes, but I apologize for that, because that's a very interesting point.
No, I definitely believe so, and I think obviously I'm unique in the fact, because I know Islamic history and obviously the religion as well. I like to see those parallels, and I find it very interesting about how everything is connected through different religions, because obviously they all follow, especially Christianity and Islam. They're all Abrahamic faiths, so they share a lot of the beliefs and ideas. You talked briefly about the Catholicism aspect, and the thing that I found really interesting was I had Andrew Graham Dixon on the podcast, who's an art historian, and he was talking about the idea of patronage. So both Caravaggio and Michelangelo both received special patronage from the Pope. So if you were an artist, the only way you could really get popular as an artist was to have the approval of the Pope to get financed for frescoes, whether they be the Sistine Chapel or David. Like, you have to have that. And in the book, you talk about this idea that British intellectuals receive special patronage for their talents. Yeah. So was this process of old corruption so rife, and why did it last so long, and is it continuing to last, this idea of old corruption?
Yes, well, I argue in the book that essentially pre-meritocratic society was a society which was based on the idea that society is ideally static, that you're born into whatever position you're born into, and that you have to stay within that position, that it's a society that's organized by families, organized around families and the transmission of power and privilege through families, as most obviously is evidenced by the royal family today in Britain. And that it also is a society that is based upon systems of patronage, nepotism, favoritism, and also the buying and selling of jobs, which is one of the most extraordinary things about the pre-meritocratic world. Jobs were like commodities, which you could buy and sell. But so you have, that's the framework of society, and society conceives itself as ideally static. But the work of the world has to be done. The people who are born into privilege aren't necessarily very bright or able or energetic. They may indeed be drunken fools. Quite often they were drunken fools. But they have to do the work of the world. So they will deliberately scout for people who can do things, who can administer things, who can run the church, who can think, who can produce great works of art or music. So within this traditional old regime, that grew up mechanisms of patronage, particularly in the church, but also in the state, whereby you're looking for people who can do things very, very well, either administrative or intellectual things very, very well. And you also begin to set up schools such as Winchester or Eton or Westminster or the rest of them, which were originally designed to take poor boys, as it was then, and train them for the priesthood or for the administrative state. And you also have a lot of people, aristocrats, who pride themselves on their ability to spot intelligent, musical, talented people and give them a leg up the social system. So there's a sense in which meritocracy grows up within the established social order, but it is always, as it were, subordinate to the established social order, and it's the social order that's trying to reproduce itself and just steal a few people from the lower classes and give them a step up, although many people have prospered from that system.
Definitely, but in reference to that, you talk about the educational elite as well. You talk about the idea that in those systems of over generations of talented individuals picking talented individuals, you get this diaspora between those individuals that are very highly educated, and then you have the people who don't obviously have that access to that level of knowledge and those people. So can you just talk about that and how the educational elite has formed?
Sure. The most obvious creator of this is the church, because the church has a rule of celibacy, so it's not reproducing itself. It has to recruit people from outside the church. Celibacy was not always practiced, but basically it had to recruit people from outside the church in each new generation to fill jobs. So the church is always looking for people, and often it's looking for scholars or it's looking for musically talented people. So it's very deliberately going around sifting people for talent. Also, the state needs to run itself, and as it becomes more complicated and sophisticated, it's looking for people with bureaucratic abilities. So if you think of, let's think of Henry VIII. Henry VIII is the most important chief of staff, as it were, is first of all Thomas Wolsey, the son of a butcher, and secondly, Thomas Cromwell, the son of a sort of ne'er-do-well, really. And Henry VIII spots them, he knows that they can do their job, he brings them in, he gets them to run the government, and then when they annoy him in various ways, he beheads them. He gets rid of them. And this pattern of choosing able administrative advisors and quite often dispatching them is very, very common in pre-modern societies. Also the pattern of the church promoting brilliant scholars or brilliant musicians is very, very common. So you do see, on the one hand, an aristocracy which perpetuates itself and sets the tone of society, but also quite dramatic processes of social mobility, because particular people, Thomas Becket is another one, particularly chosen for their administrative and intellectual skills and given a huge degree of social promotion. But it's always subordinate elements within society in order to perpetuate a society that conceives of itself as hierarchical and ideally as static as possible.
Yeah, definitely. I think we've been focusing on the West quite a bit. And one of the interesting things that I found is you talk in depth about the mandarins of China. So I had the opportunity of visiting China in 2013. I spent, after my second year at university, I taught English at a high school there, and I had the opportunity of visiting Beijing, and in particular Confucius's temple. And it was there that I kind of more embraced the idea of what Confucius was talking about with the Analects and stuff. So I found it completely fascinating when you were talking about it. And I just wanted to get your take on the differences between the European counterparts that were talking about the ideas that we've talked about and what Confucius was talking about, and how they set up their systems and this idea of self-restraint via self-cultivation.
Mm-hmm. Well, China is an absolutely extraordinary story, because whereas we had Plato writing a book about how society should be run by the men of gold and constructing a very elaborate theory, but it's nevertheless just a theory about how to organize society, we had China in many ways actually putting this into practice on a massive, massive scale. So China selects a Mandarin aristocracy through a process of rigorous exams, which are taken quite early on by about 10% of the entire population. And these are exams that test your ability to interpret and regurgitate and to mimic various Confucian texts and Confucian ways of thinking and writing about the world. And this starts very early. So by, let's say, the 9th century, China is selecting a lot of its ruling class by examinations at a time when we are run by people with names like Eric Bloodaxe. You know, we're going around chopping our way into power, and they're examining their way into power. And that system lasts all the way till 1905, when it finally collapses. So it's an extraordinary long spell of time that China is selecting a Mandarin elite, testing about 10% of the population every year to look for this talent, and conceiving of talent as the ability to read and interpret Confucian texts. And this does two things. One, it looks for talent. In order to read these Confucian texts, you have to be very well educated and very bright, because they're, you know, it's a very difficult language, they're very complicated texts. But secondly, it is teaching the ruling class how to conduct itself. So, and what Confucius says is that in order to deserve to rule, you have to, in order to deserve the job of a ruler, you have to be willing to subordinate yourself to society. You have to live a life of self-restraint. You have to obey the rules of civilization, almost. So it's not only an exercise in meritocracy in terms of selection, but it's an answer to the question, what is merit? And how does merit manifest itself? And in this case, merit is conducting yourself with restraint, with sensibility, with a enthusiasm for etiquette with an emphasis on society, but also on your bonds to your family. So it's an extraordinary theory, and it's almost, you know, it loses its credibility later because the Chinese keep testing for this Confucian ideal, even when modern science is taking off, modern technology is taking off. So they forget about that. They rule out modern science and technology. They don't include it in their examinations. So if you read an exam prep book from 1600, it would actually still be relevant in 1905. You've got this very ossified system. So it's been widely mocked, but for reasonable reasons. But it also, this kernel of saying that for a ruling class to be justified, it must be a class of people who can exercise self-discipline and self-restraint. They don't spend all their time drinking and whoring and fighting. They spend their time contemplating these great texts. That's an extraordinary thing, I think.
I felt it very similar to reading about the Spartans, in the sense that they had this very disciplined way of living. And it extended between both genders as well. I don't know, did the Chinese extend between both genders? Or was...
No, they're not that interested in educating women. I think there are a few women who disguise themselves as men and get into the system. But the Chinese, no, I think there's a great gender hierarchy. And then there's the role of eunuchs who are very important in the court as well, but not like the Spartan system.
Why was there a revolution as well? Because there was a revolution as well against that type of system in China as well, wasn't there? So what was the reason for that revolution?
Well, the reason for the revolution was that this is an all-embracing system, and the only way to get into the inner circle of society is this very narrow path. Learn the Confucian texts and become an expert on the Confucian texts. And that meant starting very young and specializing throughout your childhood. So the rewards are very high. The path to success is very prescribed. It's narrow and predetermined. And people who fail feel a great sense of loss because there's great admiration for the Confucian scholar. And so there were periodic rebellions against the system. And this the most important rebellion is the Boxer Rebellion, which has lots of causes and lots of things. But one of the causes is the anti-examination sentiment, and this killed millions and millions and millions of people. You know, this is a terrible rebellion. Also, the system remains fairly rigid at a time when the population is expanding, so it's getting harder and harder and harder because the number of places is fixed. But the population getting bigger and bigger. And there's also, I think, a growing sense that it's antiquated, that it's keeping China a prisoner in a world. So you see Britain and even Japan getting ahead, becoming technological superpowers, but you see your country allocating all its brain power into this very narrow sort of thing. So I think that creates a frustration as well. But the system is so bizarre in China that you actually have people who in their 70s and their 80s still trying to pass these examinations. It's a sort of national obsession that happens to last millennia.
Yeah, and in the book you talk about those older generations, 70s, 80-year-olds, bowing down to those who are at higher levels than them, even though they were a lot younger, which I thought was interesting, I think. I mean, I wasn't aware of that system of testing, but I think it's similar to what we were talking about Plato. I think logically it makes sense, but it does get quite antiquated when you see developments in science and that.
Absolutely, and you could link it in some ways to Plato, because although Plato is a book and an idea, it is something that that is basically built into British education. Both the Platonic ideal of what a guardian should be, and the idea of using the classics to select people for leading positions in society. And it is notable that at a time when engineering and science are really gathering pace and revolutionising the world, the British upper class is basically selecting its administrative class, at least, on the basis of its ability to do Latin and Greek and to read Plato. So we have a bit of a sort of Confucian element, and we do call our civil servants mandarins, for many reasons, but partly because they do resemble the Chinese Mandarin class of people who are educated in the classics and who are distinguished by their sort of their mode of life as much as just their intellectual abilities.
Well, I guess so. I mean, my first graduate scheme was with the Civil Service grad scheme. So
Right.
that was my job. And actually, just thinking about it, the assessment centre felt like that because it was like 9
Right.
months. It was like a 9 month process to actually get in. And I know it's very difficult to get in, and it's one of the most difficult grad schemes to get into. So as I'm thinking about it now through our conversation, I was like, oh, that kind of makes sense. That kind of makes sense. The rigorous testing is probably replicating what the Mandarins were going through.
Oh no, and when Britain introduced, when we introduced open competition into the civil service in the middle of the 19th century, in the 1850s, we looked at two models. One is the model of Plato, and the other is the Mandarin model of China. So we were very consciously modelling our system of choosing these elites on the Chinese
Interesting.
and
Okay.
system.
Well, I've gone through one of those rigorous
So
testing
you've lived
systems,
this
so
life.
I've lived it. It was incredibly stressful. But I've lived it. I've lived it. In the book as well, I think the idea of IQ and testing people, I think the idea of talent is how do you test talent? What is talent? Is it something ethereal? Like if you to look like an artist, a musician like Mozart, Beethoven, or Michelangelo, Caravaggio, like where does that talent come from, and how do you test that talent? And in the book, you give a lot of time to the idea of the rise of the IQ test. So can you talk about the IQ test in relation to this nature and nurture aspect, and how do you measure the idea of talent?
When we in Britain introduced open competition to the civil service, we did it in the middle of the 19th century, and we did it on the basis of examinations. And we said that what these examinations would do would test for people's innate abilities rather than just for their how well they'd been taught, and it would look for people's promise in later life rather than just their achievements hitherto. So we're trying to select an aristocracy of talent, people who were genuinely talented rather than people who'd been fed like sort of geese, like foie gras geese, and people who would be able to do lots and lots of different things. We were looking for a general ability. So the ability needed to be innate, it needed to be general, and it needed to be predictive of the future. How do you, that raises really interesting questions. How do you test for these things? We thought that these examinations would test for these things, but then it turns out that these examinations are in ancient, for your ability to read ancient Greek or Latin, or ability to understand the history of the United Kingdom, or your ability to read French and things like that. So there's a critique that rises saying, well, these examinations are extremely biased towards a certain category of people, i.e., people who've been to public schools in Oxford. So we need to find better ways of testing for these innate abilities. And this is where IQ testing comes in. IQ testing is essentially an attempt to provide less culturally contaminated ways of finding general ability, innate ability, and ability that can be predictive of the future. So that one of the people who comes up with ideas for these tests and comes up with a theory of how ability is distributed in the population is called Francis Galton. Then various successors come along, like Charles Spearman and Cyril Burt, who are all preoccupied by these basic questions. How can we make sure that tests are not culturally loaded? So you get tests that are much, much more abstract than tests of ability to know Latin and Greek and history. So you're looking for the ability to recognize patterns in words and numbers and predict sequences and things like that. How can we know what is the distribution of ability within the population in general? So how do we know how innate ability is distributed? So if we get only people who've been to certain schools coming top of these civil service tests, how do we know if that's a true reflection of innate ability in the population? So you get big surveys of the distribution of abilities in the population. And is there such a thing as general ability, or are there lots and lots of specific abilities, an ability to read, write, think, draw, do music? Are these abilities all drawn together? So you start off with this big question when you're looking for administrative elites: innate, general, predictive. And then you move away from sort of university style tests towards much more these puzzles which are supposed to predictability, and these elaborate theories of the distribution of ability in the population. But I think that IQ testing starts off as critique of an educational system which inevitably distributes its favours, and an administrative system which inevitably distributes its favours to the well-educated. And it's asking the question, well, you know, can we look beneath this veneer of education to find true ability, or ability in its purest form? And IQ tests are, again, a solution to Plato's great problem. Plato's great problem is, how can we find the men of gold? How can we find the men of silver? How can we find the men of bronze, given that the parents and children are not identical? How can we sift the population and make the population mobile so that the opportunity and ability reflect each other as closely as possible?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because when I transferred from university in relation to the testing that I did for the civil service, it was like, you're tested in university on your ability to memorize. So even if you're writing an essay, you're memorizing dates in reference to history or a certain way of politics. I studied politics, so a certain political theory in relation to the question. And then when you went to your testing for the civil service, it moved to more personality tests, spatial awareness tests, like how do you, like you said, recognize patterns. And it's not so much about your ability to memorize, it's your ability to dissolve complex ideas into something that can be used in the practical world.
So this problem of how do we get away from just rewarding memory and just rewarding being well taught drives the British to create the 11 plus system, which is a system designed to find clever people in the whole of the population, and becomes absolutely massively determining of people's lives. So after the 1944 Education Act was introduced, everybody had to sit the 11 plus. This lasts, and everybody's life could be determined by whether they pass or fail the 11 plus, although the upper classes go to private schools because they get out of the system. But it's sort of a Calvinist system. You're either saved or you're damned. And it becomes an incredibly powerful mechanism of sorting the population, determining millions and millions and millions of people's lives, producing a lot of happiness and a lot of misery as a result of this. So this is a very interesting example of the way that a theory, a scientific theory, a technology, a social technology, it's massively shaping society and has a huge impact on society. We tend to think of in Britain that we're a pragmatic people, that we don't serve ideologies and things like that, or scientific theories. But this is an area in which, you know, society is organized around this set of theories. In America, they do exactly the same thing with the SATs and IQ tests, but they're sorting within schools, not between schools. So there's a lot of sorting that goes on, and they're using these to determine admission to, not determine, but to influence admission into universities as well. But you don't have this sharp distinction between sheep and goats at the age of 11. But nevertheless, IQ tests come from this problem: how do we find innate ability? And they shape societies, particularly Britain and the United States, to an extraordinary degree. They begin to lose support in Britain. The IQ tests, the 11 plus, is abolished, and in America, it's sort of watered down. The SATs are watered down. But it's a huge, and I talk a lot about this in the book, because I think it's the closest we've come in the West to sort of imitating the Chinese sort of examination state.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And that's why I wanted to bring it up, because I definitely think that, I feel anyway, in the education system, we're too focused on what the job that we want to do, or what do we want to do, rather than perhaps focusing on the skills and the things that make individuals and future leaders of our society good at. Like, what are the skills needed in order to make someone who wants to lead an organization well, rather than just memorizing a certain historical event or whatever it might be. Whereas I think that formulating IQ test earlier might be a better way of predicting what individuals are best at.
Well, I'd certainly use IQ tests much more than we do at the moment for admission, particularly to admission to universities, which are very much tests of achievement. And what we've tended to do is to supplement tests of achievement in terms of passing A levels and O levels with these really weird personal statements, which I think are about as useless as anything could possibly be, because what they basically test is sort of social privilege, social advantage, you know. People's personal statements, you can be coached in personal statements, but they're not really personal statements. They're parades of your cultural privilege, quite often, with a little bit of cultural lack of privilege thrown in for effect.
Definitely with experience as well, because I know they ask for experience as well. And the only real way that you get experience pre-university is through any type of network or privilege that you might have.
Absolutely.
So I definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
Especially for those that want to do a certain type of qualification. I think you have to have a level of experience, whether that be banking or economics or finance.
Yeah.
You definitely need some experience. And the only way you get that is by knowing someone or having someone that you know. So,
absolutely.
Which I think is very interesting. Can you talk a bit about, we've been talking about sort of the formation of meritocracy, the idea of why it's important, but can you talk about some of the critiques? So in the book, you dedicate two chapters, one to the left, the political left, and one to the political right. And the political left taking issue with how merit is measured, and instead we should focus more on equality. And I know we've just talked about that in reference to the IQ test, and also the political right focusing more on, you know, provinces versus the capitals, and a move back to nationalism, as we've discussed with Trump. And you can reference that to Nigel Farage and Brexit and stuff. So can you explain why both sides of the political debate are moving away from this idea of meritocracy?
Well, we had a big revolt against meritocracy on the left, which starts in the 1930s with just worries that IQ tests aren't very accurate measures of ability, but then broadens out into a much more general cultural critique of meritocracy, which says that meritocracy has essentially smuggled a false ideal into the socialist idea of equality. And that false ideal is equality of opportunity created through competition. And it says, well, this is what we as socialists really believe in, is equality and community and fraternity. And what we don't believe in is equality of opportunity, which is just another excuse for people to compete with each other. So that's, and that was brilliantly expressed, I think, in the book which gave the term meritocracy to us all, which was written by Michael Young, called The Rise of the Meritocracy in 1958. And The Rise of the Meritocracy was, contrary to people's memory, not a celebration of this great progressive process of meritocracy, but was a critique of meritocracy. It said it created a society in which we're all elbowing each other aside to try and get to the front of the queue. That's not socialism, he says, that's just capitalism by other means. So that's the sort of the broad left-wing critique, and it's a critique which leads to the abolition of the grammar schools, the creation of comprehensive schools, the creation of mixed ability classes and things like that. And it's a critique which survives now very vigorously, I think, in the form of the argument that meritocracy is just propaganda for plutocrats. It's the argument that meritocracy is just a way in which people who are sitting at the top of the system can justify why they're at the top. So I would say, in the letters that I've got and the tweets and the emails I've got in reaction to this book, a lot of people are saying, without reading the book, I would say, but they're saying, all you're trying to do is justify the status quo, and the status quo stinks. Well, I agree that the status quo stinks, but I'm not trying to justify in this book at all. So that's the left-wing critique.
In reference to the leftist critique, I think it's important to understand that the leftist critique is, I think, at the moment, talking a lot more about equality of outcome rather than equality of opportunity.
Absolutely.
So do you feel like a lot of people are looking at through the lens of equality of outcome rather than equality?
Absolutely. So I didn't make myself clear enough, but what I'm trying to say about Michael Young is he says that the socialist world wants equality of outcome, not equality of opportunity. They want differences to be minimized. And what's happened by left-wingers like Tony Blair, if he was a left-winger, embracing meritocracy as he did, was just a way of justifying wide equalities of outcome. They say we don't want these wide equalities of outcome, however they're attained, whether they're attained by meritocratic means or by other means. We want a more equal society. That's our values. So more recently, what we've seen is a big rejection of meritocracy by the right, And the right says that these meritocrats, these experts, are snobs. They look down on us. They are arrogant. They are justifying their positions of privilege in meritocratic terms. And they are basically the people who ruin the world with the financial crisis, ruin the world with neoliberalism, ruin the world with globalization, and they just don't care about ordinary people. And that's, you know, if you listen to Fox TV, that's, if you happen to listen to Fox TV, that is a constant theme. Tucker Carlson says this all the time. It's a constant theme. If you read The Sun, it keeps coming up. These snobs, they think that they know better than us. They're clever pants, but they actually have made a mess of the world. And these left-wing and the right-wing critiques actually intersect quite a lot. There's the same set of prejudices working there. Now, there's always been left-wing critiques of meritocracy. There's always been right-wing critiques of meritocracy. There's always been middle-of-the-road critiques of meritocracy. But what's happened now is that the left and the right and the centre have all come together in rejecting meritocracy. There's never been such a broadly based critique of this idea, which in my opinion made the modern world, and it's never had quite such a wide range of impacts as it's happening at the moment. So these critiques are not only generalized, but they've gathered momentum and they're beginning to shape social policy in very fundamental ways.
What is that shared critique then between the left, middle and right?
Well, the shared critique is that the meritocratic elite isn't really meritocratic. It's self-serving. It's grabbed positions for itself, and it's arrogant. It looks down on us, and it's made a mess of the world, most particularly in the financial crisis, that it's not governed the world very well. I think there's a lot of truth in that critique, although I would argue that the way forward is to have a purer meritocracy rather than to dismantle the whole idea of meritocracy. But yeah, it's a hard argument to deal with.
It's a hard argument to deal with because obviously you can't refute that in relation to the financial crisis. But yeah, it's absolutely. Also important to understand that the shaping of our civilization, especially in the West, has been through that meritocracy. So it's like you can't just refute the whole system itself, the idea of meritocracy, because it's what's built our system of democracy, as well as our economic system, political system,
absolutely,
judicial system,
yes.
And they just want to, I guess, just see the system go.
Yeah, but I mean, do we want to go back to the pre-meritocratic world where jobs were bought and sold, where people inherited jobs from their parents, where the idea of social mobility was anathema? No, I don't think we want to go back. But where do we go from here? Do we try and reduce meritocracy, squeeze it out, or do we try and purify it? So there's a very lively debate about that at the moment. I'm on one side of the debate. There's a lot of people on the other side of the debate. But you know, some people, I think, would generally want to get rid of meritocracy. I mean, there are two schools, at least in the United States, Lowell School in San Francisco and Boston Latin School in Boston, which are now abolishing entrance exams and replacing them by lotteries for places. These were once elite academic schools, which are moving from a clearly meritocratic system to a lottery system, which is clearly not meritocratic. So there's a lot of people who take this critique very, very seriously.
How do you go about answering some of the questions in relation to the West being fundamentally prejudiced against certain ethnic groups? Because we had Kehinde Andrews, who's a professor at the University of Birmingham, talking about Age of Empire. So he's talking about how the West is fundamentally against black and brown people. How does the idea of meritocracy relate? Do individuals who have that point of view usually see meritocracy as a bad thing, or do they see meritocracy as inherently just a colonial view?
I would say that in my view, meritocracy is an inherently radical idea, which is inherently a critique of the status quo, and which says that people should be judged according to their individual abilities, their individual merits, not according to what broad group they belong to. And that is, by its very nature, a revolutionary idea. And what we have seen throughout history is subordinate groups seizing on the idea of merit and meritocracy as a way of saying to superior groups, I mean superior in not in a moral sense, but in a positional sense, superior groups, judge us by your standards, give us the chances that you've been given, and we will show our abilities. So in the middle of the 19th century, let's say, we had a system whereby opportunities were being opened up to men through open competition. And a lot of women came along and said, well, that's not fair. You can't just have open competition for men and not have it for women, because all the arguments that apply to men also apply to women. And so that came, and you know, by the very force of that logic, we eventually opened up administrative positions, fellowships, university places to women. They were, nowhere sort of failed to listen to that argument. It took a long time, but you saw that argument. You saw the same thing with working class groups coming along and saying, well, it's not fair that only Etonians go to Oxford. We should go to Oxford. We're just as clever. We have the abilities. And they came along and said, judge us by your standards. And you got the rise of these scholarship children who did fantastically well. You got the rise of WEA, Workers' Education Associations, of workers who were measured by the same standards, who learnt their Latin, who learnt their Greek, who learnt their classic texts. You got the rise of people such as Nye Bevan and Ernest Bevin, who proved by their own abilities that they were capable of running huge organisations. And so meritocracy is, by its nature, always pushing established hierarchies aside to create new opportunities for new subordinate groups. And you can see exactly the same thing with ethnic minorities. So look at the way that when Britain created open competition in the Indian civil service, you get the rush of Indians to get administrative jobs in India. You get the rush of Indians coming to Oxford and Cambridge, Trinity and Balliol. My college was Balliol, had a very large group of Indians from a very early period. It had those things. So their argument is, judge us by the same standards, and standards that are a bit elastic, that change over time. Judge us by these standards, and we will do just as well as you. And I think that has tended to change. So I think if you're going to say it's an inherently racist, imperialist project, it's very hard to explain why so many people not from dominant groups succeeded within that system. And again, the classic example of this is Jewish populations, which have flourished under competitive examination systems to an extraordinary degree, so they're overrepresented. And if you look at British intellectual history in the 20th century, it's been extraordinarily shaped by people who are not white Anglo-Saxons and didn't come from that white Anglo-Saxon background. So my view of meritocracy is that it's a set of standards that you can judge people against. And these standards, you know, it is true that there was a dominance of English speaking authors. That's now changing. So you're getting English, you know, you're getting a wider range of authors. The canonical texts are changing and being broadened to include many people from Indian backgrounds or Indian upbringings or Black American backgrounds or the rest of it. But basically, what really worries me about the sort of arguments that your gentleman is pointing to is the idea that people should be judged as members of groups, particularly members of racial groups, rather than as individuals. Because one thing that we know from IQ tests, from examination results, from the rest of them, is that the range of differences within groups is absolutely massive. And I think it's the essence of a liberal society to judge people on the basis of individual groups, not to forget about patterns of traditional exploitation and discrimination, and particularly in the United States with the legacy of slavery. You have to take that into account, but your aim is always to judge people individually, not collectively.
I think that's the benchmark of what makes our society great, is that we judge people by either individuals rather than a group. Rather than a certain ethnic group.
Well, ideally, I think in the United States, because of slavery and the legacy of slavery, you have to take that into account, because it has created structural inequalities of opportunity, because it was a particular abomination, and slavery around the world was a particular abomination. So you do have to take into account this, but your aim should always be, in the long term, to have a society judging people on individual abilities, and to have a society which doesn't judge people on their membership of collectivities. Because if you go back to the pre-meritocratic world, everything was about belonging to a collectivity, whether it was an aristocratic caste or a clan or a guild or, you know, people who came from Shropshire or the rest of it. That was the way they thought. And the society now, I think, is ideally organized around the individual, not around the group.
There's the issue I have with Arabic societies at the moment, especially in Saudi Arabia and the UAE,
because everything's
done through the idea of nepotism. It's like, if you're not part of the royal family, then you don't get anything. And it's something that I take massive issue with, especially being a Muslim and they call themselves under a Muslim society. It's like, you stand for everything that's against it. And it's just purely nepotism.
And one of the arguments in my book is that we need more meritocracy rather than less meritocracy. And one of the places where this needs to be applied more than anywhere else are oil-rich countries that have managed to preserve, well, kinship networks, which rule society, essentially.
Even in Russia as well, with the oligarchy, it's exactly the same thing. The idea that you can just buy favors with the Russian elite, and then you get given... You basically just get quoted things based on how much you are willing to give to the political elite. So, yeah, definitely. And I think at the book you talk about
meritocracy.
Yeah, definitely. I think the idea you talk about as well is a call for a more wiser meritocracy. So what does that wiser meritocracy look like, and how can we become reacquainted with the historical importance of meritocracy? Because that's actually what I think your book is. Your book is a call to have a look back at history, to have a look at why meritocracy is so important, and how can we move forward with a, like you said, a wiser view. So what is that wiser view of meritocracy?
Well, what I argue in my book is there's a lot of call for getting rid of meritocracy or diluting it. And I say, well, look at meritocracy historically, and you'll see what an extraordinary progressive thing it has been. But also look at it historically, and you'll see what an incredibly rich thing it has been. And one of the things it is being concerned with is the relationship between talent and virtue. And we've always had the idea that it's not just enough to have talent, you must also exercise that talent in a virtuous way. And I think one of the things that's happened in the last 20 or 30 years, partly because of IQ tests, which are supposed to be pure tests of ability, but also partly because of the rise of a new ruling class that thinks it's there only because of its talent, because they deserve it, is their phrase, we deserve it, is you've had a demoralization of merit, that the people who come to the top of society think that they're there on their own bat. They're like, somebody once said of George H.W. Bush that he was born at third base and thought that he'd hit a triple. And these people are the same. They think they deserve it. So they're willing to be much more greedy, I think, or overtly greedy than previous members of the ruling class. If you look at ex-prime ministers like Tony Blair or David Cameron, they're grubby and self-enriching in a way that people like Harold Wilson, I don't think, ever were.
So, by the way, with Boris Johnson, because I know a couple of weeks ago it was announced that he had appointed individuals based on him being part of their club at university as well. So I think it still continues.
Absolutely. So I think that what you had in the past was an idea that if you were born talented, that is something that which is a privilege and something that is almost God-given, and you have to give something back to thank God or society for that talent. And so if you look at what happened in Britain in the middle of the 19th century, you had a country that was run by a bunch of very self-interested aristocrats who were essentially plundering the public sector for sinecures and jobs and to make themselves rich. And you had a moral reformation in the middle of the 19th century, which was not just opening opportunities to in the civil service to talented people, but also saying, if you're a civil servant, you're doing a public job, and you've got to exercise your privileges and your powers with restraint when it comes to money and with dignity. The same in the Chinese system, the sense that if you're going to be a ruler, you have to have an education in virtue as well as an education just in technology. And I think we need to do that again. We need to make sure that the ruling class has a sense, a much deeper sense than it's got at the moment, of its obligations to society, should be educated in self-restraint, not just stuffing itself with gold in the way that it has been doing, and should understand that it's very lucky. It's not because we're worth it or they're worth it. It's because society has entrusted them with obligations. That's why I come back to Plato. And Plato is fascinating on this subject, because his whole education of the guardian is not just an intellectual education, but it's a moral education into how you relate to the rest of society, what you have to give back because you're born a man of gold, in his view.
That's why I feel like it's more of a move at the moment away. We're so focused on, for instance, in relation to technology, we're so enamored with the individual who is so intelligent, the one who's so out there, that the idea of what is ethical and moral has sort of gone out the window. We don't see them to be balanced. We see the ethical and moral to be those people that are somewhat ascetic. It's the ascetics that live away in the caves and in their scholarly places, and they're just sort of there with their ethics. And the people who are actually doing things, they don't care about ethics. They just care about individual freedom. And I think the thing that I love about the idea of meritocracy that you talk about in this book is that there is an idea of self restraint and a lack of freedom that enables meritocracy to flourish, rather than a pursuit of too much freedom that actually degrades the idea of meritocracy.
Well, you see, one of the things is that people argue that meritocracy is propaganda for plutocrats and is a way of justifying the capitalist order and sort of an Ayn Randian sort of justification for the status quo. But my view is that meritocracy is a counterbalance in many ways to capitalism, and a counterbalance to the logic of the argument, which to the logic of the market, which says A, we have to make sure that we provide equality of opportunity. Whatever your parents are, you should have, you know, something approximating to the same opportunities as richer people. But also that must deliberately select a sort of civil service elite which can look in long term rather than in the short term, which can act as a counterbalance to the way that markets overshoot, overemphasize the short term, and should always be looking for the long term. We haven't talked about this, but I talk a lot in the book about Singapore, which I think has had a sort of state-guided modernization, which would have been impossible through a pure free market system, because the state was always trying to think 10 years ahead and trying to look at where society was headed, where the economy was headed, rather than just responding to short-term market signals.
Definitely. That was actually the next point I was going to raise before we ended up, is the idea that in Singapore, is this idea of conformity is more important than the idea of, for instance, freedom. Like, to conform is much more important than to have this idea of you can do anything that you want. And I was just interested about your take on the idea that restraint and conformity is what is needed in order for a true meritocracy to flourish.
Well, I would say restraint is needed. I'm not sure about conformity. I think that Singapore has massively overshot in terms of emphasizing rote learning or formulaic problem solving rather than innovative and creative thinking.
So do you feel like they're taking what China did and sort of just replicating it, where they're going to get to a stage where they're going to have a revolution of a degree,
well,
and they'll get
rid
of it?
Not that they'll have a revolution, but they're replicating it. What they're doing, and what the Chinese are now doing, is emphasizing science and engineering education. So in terms of commanding the future, they're in a much better position than China was in 1905. It's not a Confucian education, but it is an education in deference, I think. And I do worry that it's going too far. So I like the idea that they've got an administrative elite which, by the standards of much of the rest of the world, is relatively self-denying. Certainly by the standards of Zimbabwe, let's say, or somewhere like that, is a self-denying elite. But I do worry that there's too much deference. As I say, you know, you have a spectrum between equality and meritocracy, and a spectrum between democracy and meritocracy. I think they've gone too far towards pure meritocracy. We need much more creativity, much more democracy than they have. But nevertheless, if you look at the progress they've made since the early 1960s, it's absolutely astonishing. They're doing more right than wrong.
Yes, definitely. I would definitely agree with that. Anyway, Adrian, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak about your book, The Aristocracy of Talent: How Meritocracy Made the Modern World.
Thank
Where's the
you.
best place for people to find you online, social media, website?
My Twitter handle is at AD Waldridge.
Perfect. Is that the only one you've got? Are you just purely Twitter?
I'm just purely Twitter, I'm afraid.
Okay, that's fine. I like
And
that.
my name has got all these D's. Well, you know that my name's got all these D's in it. So at AD Waldridge. So that would be good. And I will retweet anything you. I'm not doing any other stuff, which I probably ought to be. But the social media evolves at a much faster pace than my ability to read social
Do you know
media does,
what?
I'm afraid.
I respect you for just having one, Adrian. I think one's enough to manage, definitely. So yes, I'll put your handle
Yes.
at the bottom of this description. So if
Thank you.
anyone wants
That
to,
was a fascinating discussion.
yes,
I
thank
really
you.
enjoyed it.
Thank you for
Thanks.
taking the time.
Yes. No problem.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe for more content. Also, visit our website, www.booktalktoday.com, to subscribe and download the latest edition of our magazine. Join our mailing list to receive the first issue for free to get a taste for the value-packed content that we are offering. Book Talk Today, for readers, by readers.